Yeah. All right. Well, hey, let's get into tonight because we got a bit of ground to cover. You know, we talked about the golden age of medieval Christianity. We talked about the height of the papacy and the mendicant orders and all sorts of these things that really gave spice to understanding the high Middle Ages. The fall, however, the medieval age is equally as interesting, if not important. As you well know, when things go well, theology tends to suffer. When things go horribly, theology tends to suffer. And this is why it's always a challenge. But the issues of theology and the issues of Christian life get affected different ways during times of prosperity versus times of suffering. Times of prosperity throughout the medieval time led to, well, like all things, when you prosper, the laziness and the carelessness that people tend to live their lives with, comparatively speaking, leads to a similar aspect in theology and in church life. You get comfortable. There's certain aspects to Christian life that tend to get lax, to say the least. The same thing goes with theology. And so when we start talking about times of suffering coming after that, usually that transition is not handled so well. And it goes the other way as well. We saw one of the most significant transitions from suffering into opulence in the 4th century, if anyone recalls, and that was the rise of monasticism to begin with. You know, we need to suffer. You get on the other side of that, on the other side of prosperity, when prosperity goes away, you'll get Christians going, we need to prosper. We need to go back to the way it was. When everything was great, we need to figure out how to remake and recapture that magic. Whether the early magic was suffering or prosperity, it doesn't matter. It's always nostalgic towards what it was. And that applies to the collapse of the medieval era. Now, the reality is there's no real way to talk about church history, especially at this point, without just talking about normal history. When you're discussing this era of time, you have to discuss things like climate. You have to discuss things like the Black Death. You have to discuss things like the monarchy in France, for instance. These things have such an effect on the church and the way that the church thinks of itself, that all of them are going to come to the fore this evening. So if you want to kind of get the setting, we're going to be in the late 13th century, mid 14th century, so late 1200s, 1300s, up till about maybe 1400, and we're going to kind of stop shy of there. I want to kind of get the cultural milieu if you can, because a lot of the things that change over the course of the next couple of centuries have a lot to do with perception, the way that the average Christian will perceive the papacy, or the average Christian will perceive the monarchies that are arising up out of Western Europe. Because believe it or not, it wasn't like before America came around, there was just always kings all the way back to the beginning of the world. It didn't work like that. As you know, well know, in the medieval time, most of what you were dealing with was feudalism. The feudal lord had more to do about your life than any king that ever tried to do anything. This is why when we talk about someone like Charlemagne and the claims of him being the Holy Roman Emperor, nobody really cares. I mean, if he can benefit your life, great, but the Holy Roman Emperor or whatever chieftain or whatever is not going to have anywhere near as much say in your life as a feudal lord who owns the land on which you live and your children and everything else. It's not exactly slavery, but it has much more to do with almost a concept of fatalistic, this is the way things always will be, and what's the point in trying to change such things? Now, we've made reference to things like the Magna Carta, which was a callback to an earlier day of democratic ideals. People and nobles should be able to vote in certain things or have say in certain things, in certain aspects. But then you also have a whole other layer of society, kings arguing with popes. Who has the ultimate authority? When it comes to the stuff of this world or when it comes to the stuff of heaven, that seems to be pretty clear. But what about when they disagree? Who's to win? Because at the end, to quote, I think it was Mel Gibson who said this when he was trying to find the top of like some mafia, And they were claiming, oh, no, these two guys run everything. He says, no, no, no. It always comes down to one guy. Who's the guy? Who's the one in charge of everything, right? And that really comes to a head here. When you start to see the height of the papacy in someone like Pope Innocent II, right around the 1200, but then you start to see that declining. You start to see the effects of the papacy start to crumble, because what's the thing that we know about power? It corrupts. It doesn't matter where it is. It doesn't matter what the intention was. It doesn't matter anything. Even if you establish a position, let's say papacy, and you hold that power very, very well and morally and with high virtue, when you die, which is a certainty, everything you've laid foundation-wise will almost certainly be taken over by somebody of lower virtue. It's always the way of history. It doesn't matter how good something is, and you can see this pattern with kings, you can see it with popes. When a great king arises, what happens with his son? He's a spoiled, crazy person that didn't build anything that he's standing on, and he crumbles the empire. All the time this happens. All the time. And so the same thing happens with the papacy. Now, the papacy was trying to structure itself not to be like that. So it wasn't necessarily hereditary, though many, many popes were all of the same family, and so here you have a whole other problem. But the reality is, the papacy, by the end of the 1200s, took the strength that Innocent III had and had so degraded itself with trying to gain more and more power that by the time we come to the end of the 1200s, we come across a really interesting pope, one of my favorites from the medieval era, a guy who was pope for 5 months, Pope Celestine V. No, he did not die. Pope Celestine V, he hated his office. He hated being pope. He didn't want to be. He was a monk through and through. Remember what we understand between the two powers throughout the... The two forces that affected the direction of the church throughout the medieval era was the papacy and the monasteries. When the crossover happens between monasteries and papacy, it really is a very unnatural fit. A monk does not want to be a pope. There's just no getting along. They attract two completely different types of people in the 13th century. And Pope Celestine V learned this kind of the hard way. He was the one that is credited to say it is at this point not possible to be a good Christian and to also be a pope. One must choose. It's an interesting statement, he says, as pope. He would, and when he is expressing this, he says that there is no way that I'm going to be pope. I would rather be a good Christian. In fact, I'd rather be a monk. I'd rather live in complete obscurity. I don't want anything to do with any of this stuff. It's not possible to be a good Christian and to be a pope. So I'm going to call together and issue a decree making it possible for popes to resign, which he did. And then he resigned and went back to becoming a monk.
What precedent of becoming pope? That's what I was beginning.
So his story is one of being forced into it by a series of, let's just say, Italian ways. And there was a hope that he would be a puppet, and because there was a lack of, let's just say, people on their side. But when he got there, he found out that everything that he wanted to do was not going to be possible. Well, we can't possibly figure out how to do that. So you just need to do this. Appoint these cardinals, appoint these bishops. And he was just like, this is not how I'm going to do these things. So I just love the decree that he issues, making it possible for a pope to resign and retire.
Monk pope.
There's a lot of popes that I'm not that familiar with. He's the only one I know of. That probably means absolutely not he's the only one. But he would be the only one I know of, at least in the last 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Sorry, trying to go through all the popes that I know. There's a lot of them that come from similar ordered things, but as far as monks becoming popes, yeah, it really pulls from two different sides of the church. I would almost say he's probably the last, and maybe this is one of the reasons, but if not the last, I'd be surprised to see another after him. What's that? Most exclamatory way to resign, that's for sure. I'm going to choose between being a Christian or being a pope. Yeah, you can't be both. I like that one. Interesting guy. So what happens after him is the person that helped convince him to step down is actually elected as pope, which is really interesting.
So is he successful in becoming a monk again and paid off in those
two? No. No, he did, and he actually was imprisoned, what's that? Yeah, pretty much, and he died in prison under the guard of the next pope, who was the one who convinced him to resign and elect him pope.
Coincidence.
Yeah, complete coincidence, all of them are. Unfortunately, it was, it was the 1300s, and there's only so much one can do, or the late 1200s, rather. You have a number of forces at play going on in the world right at that point, and a lot of things coming together that are new forces in Europe. Before this, you really don't have kings that are overly powerful in Western Europe. You will have kings, you will have certain aspects of this, but most of them are kind of the stuff of legends, like they're really high-end military commanders, Arthurian legends and things like this. You'll get really broad chieftains and things like this, but you will not get king like you and I think of king until really about the late 1200s. That's something that's enormously shifting at this point while the papacy is losing its power, and that's not by accident. Those things do not live nicely next to each other. And when they're trying to figure out how it is that authority works in the world, where you have people and nobles and then you have feudal lords that are starting to lose their power and influence, and now you have people that have much more of a growing national concept. Remember, we talked about the rise of things like monetary systems. One of the things that brings nations together, first thing that brings nations together more than anything, is war. Nothing helps national pride like wars. And if you want wars, go look up France and England. They love going to war. It's their favorite thing. They love fighting each other. Always has been. In fact, until the 1900s, I really don't know of a time where they were on the same side of something. Were they ever? I don't even know. Even in the American Revolution, who is it that we had to help defeat the British? The French. That kind of thing has always happened. The Hundred Years' War was going on at this time, and that's one of the things that really helps bolster national concept and identity out of I belong to my feudal lord. Well, rise in monetary policy also goes hand in hand with war. Well, who needs the funding? Kings. Used to be the higher knights. Now it is to pay people that are being released from these things, hiring that. Now you have a rise in nationalism that comes from a unified currency. No longer do we have to trust that this feudal lord is stamping his silver and it's pure enough. Now you can actually have, now it's the king's face on it. We haven't had kind of that stuff since Rome. Not in the West, anyway. It's always been tribal leaders. It's always been local lords. It's always been things like this. The rise of the monarchies, the strong monarchies in Western Europe, give rise to the nations, give rise to the monetary policies, give rise to central powers in cities, moving from rural to cities, and setting them up for what's to come. When you come to about 1300, you have the rise of things like England, France, those two massive monarchies between people like King John that were going up against Innocent III, or you have, for instance, King Philip IV of France, who may well be considered one of the strongest kings in France's history. You don't have a Germany yet. That doesn't come until much later. Same with Italy. You still have the Papal States and all sorts of divided up things. Spain is still casting out the Moors and working on their thing. But as far as for France, it becomes one of the strongest powers of a national identity that there is in Western Europe, at least on the continent. England and France, again, are about to go into the Hundred Years' War at this point. This is one of the aspects of it. If there's someone you really want to pay attention to, just kind of understand monarchy systems at this time, King Philip IV of France is someone to look at. He's king for about 30 years, like the last 15 years of the 1200s and the first 15 years of the 1300s. He is an iron-fisted ruler in France. About 80 years before this, the Fourth Lateran Council gave kings the ability to tax clergy for purposes of crusades. Now that the crusades are over and that law is still on the books, guess what's going to happen? Well, he takes advantage of it to tax the French church. The Pope condemns this. The Pope is technically correct. The king can't call for a crusade and then therefore tax churches. That has to be issued by the Pope. And so the Pope says, you didn't do this correctly. That's on mine. And that's my ability. That's crossing into my authority in my territory. And King Philip then imposed an embargo on all trade and revenue to the papacy. All. No money, no support, no food, no nothing. And Pope Boniface in 1297 caves to Philip IV. That's an important thing. King Philip IV takes the papal legate, the Pope's messenger, and accuses him of sedition and treason. Pope Boniface responds to this in 1301 with a very threatening letter to threaten a church council to depose Philip as an illegitimate king. Do you see this ending well?
Maybe for Philip.
Yeah. Philip calls the Estates General in 1302, which is made up of clergy, nobility, and laity, all French, of course, why not? And they together issue individual requests that the Pope do not do what he threatens with regards to removing and deposing Philip as an illegitimate king. Pope Boniface continues and refuses, and instead holds a council, and they release one of the most overwhelming statements that the papacy ever released, called Unum Sanctum. You should write that down and you should go read it. Unum Sanctum. Remember that Innocent III, to really coalesce his power, argued that the papacy was akin to the sun, S-U-N, in the sky, and that the kings were essentially the moon. Both of them are the created lights in the sky, but one has more glory than the other because one deals with spiritual matters and the other deals with earthly, but they are parallel, et cetera, et cetera. This is one of the reasons why Innocent III was able to make so much headway with regards to power for the papacy. Well, Boniface, not quite the same level of political sanity. Unum Sanctum expresses that the Pope himself is not just lord over the spiritual interests of the people in Europe, all of Europe, but since the body is subject to the soul. Now he takes it out of the creation language with regards to like the sun and the moon. And he says, since the body is subject to the soul, so the physical rulers ought to be subject to the Pope having superior authority.
So would you say the Pope?
The Pope was arguing that he has authority over the kings.
Because the spiritual
realm. Because the spiritual should have superiority over the physical. It would be akin to me going up to the mayor of Binghamton and going, since I'm a pastor and I look over spiritual matters, you answer to me now.
Just a couple of tears up in power.
Instead of a, we're, you know, powerful, you know, this and that, or separate, you know, whatever. The reality is, power corrupts eventually. It always does. And so how do you think Philip the Fourth responds to that? Yeah, he sends his military to capture the Pope. Puts him in prison, where the Pope dies several months later. The prevailing theory is that it was likely as a result of his injuries during time in captivity that nobody knows how he got them. Also, the Pope had actually excommunicated King Philip IV, which when Philip captured and, let's just say, accidentally murdered the Pope, he installs a new Pope who then re-communicates him to the Church, which the Catholic Church now actually declares that that Pope is an anti-Pope, which means a fake Pope. Yeah, we're going to start to get fake Popes now, by the way, where you get, they're called anti-Popes in Catholic history. What's that? Worse, actually. Worse, actually, because this one affects so many other things. Because what if they held a council? Now that council is defamed. Now you can't, you know, any decision they make is completely legitimate. You got all sorts of problems that arise with anti-popes, especially when we get to the time where there's actually three popes at one point, where they're all excommunicating each other. And yeah, my boys. Usually it's two. Yeah. Well, actually, usually it's one, but commonly it was two, and there was at 1.3, yes. Fun stuff. So the Pope that Philip tries to put in restores Philip back to communion with the Catholic Church and then dies a few months later, which is really just fun. No, the Pope that Philip put in, that the Catholic Church now says wasn't a real Pope, which is fun stuff. 2 years later, Pope Clement V, who's a French guy. this is in 1305. He didn't want to move to Rome. He wanted to stay in France. Rome, he says, was a horrible place. Too many Italians. Nobody wants to go there, especially this time of year. And so he instead seeks to set up the head of the Catholic Church in France. In Avignon. What's that? There is a schism later on. Yes, indeed. At first, however, the papacy literally sets up shop in Avignon, France. I'm not talking about just the Pope. I'm talking about all the cardinals. Everything moves from Rome to Avignon, and there they conduct the papacy, not for a year or two, not for 10 years, but for 70 years. The papacy is French. For the first whole decade, actually, under the very, very close watchful eye of Philip IV, who is king of France, who essentially has, for all intents and purposes, captured the Roman Catholic Church and made it French. It's really impressive what he did. I just say that purely from the political risk that he took to pull off what he did and how successful it was, because it was successful. The papacy is in Avignon, in really under the careful and watchful eye of the French monarchy from 1305 to 1376. That's crazy. That means for a couple of generations, not only was the papacy in France, but the popes were French. And all under the thumb of the French monarchy.
Well, and what a crazy swing from a time where it looked like all indications were that the papacy was going to rule supreme and try to.
Yep.
No, that's not how it ends.
Everyone called everyone's bluffs. Yeah. And as it turns out, king with army beats pastor every time. Yep. Every time. And you know, it's kind of like today, right? We have a check and balance in our system of government, right? But only one branch of the government has a military. Which one is that? Yeah, it's the executive branch. If the executive branch wants to become a tyrant, there is literally nothing the judicial or the legislative bodies can do about it. Nothing. If someone gets in as president and just wants to rule and become a military dictatorship, I mean, there's literally 9 justices on the Supreme Court. What can they do? They have no army. They have no budget. They can't do anything. It's all based on trust in our system of government. The executive branch can just take it over. So let's see this. This is essentially like just an executive branch and then a kind of spiritual judicial branch, which is the papacy. When they're starting to call each other's bluffs to see who would really do this, at the end, the guy with all the guns and pointy things wins. That's just the way history works. And Philip IV knew that, and he really didn't seemingly care what the Pope thought about him, which is a completely different era of history we just entered, isn't it? You know, before this, you have popes that are installing Holy Roman emperors. Now you have popes that are being captured by kings. It's amazing what war and monetary policies can do. The reality is there was enough good things that were happening in the world. There was enough plentiful food for everyone. But then when suffering starts entering into the fray, and when I say suffering, I mean a number of things that we don't usually talk about outside of history class, and it certainly never come up in church history. We have things like the medieval warm period were coming to an end. Medieval warm period, whether you know it or not, was a time where actually Europe was warmer than it is now. It was coming to an end. Agriculture was starting to fail. Things were starting to go downhill. Well, what happens? Well, monarchies get desperate and papacy looks like it's not really doing its job. God isn't blessing us. Right? Think about that just on the local church level. If things are going bad, who do we tend to try to blame? It's always, right? Usually the pastor or the board of elders or something. So it must go well. And if things aren't going well, then it must be their fault somehow or another. Papacy is subject to that extremely, because if things are going bad in Europe, you just said in Unum Sanctum that you're in charge of Europe. And then the popes will come back. No. That there must be some sins in your life. You guys got to repent of all these things. Realize all of this stuff is happening. If you're familiar with timelines, 1300s leads to an enormous amount of shifts and changes. And the papacy is in France almost that entire time. What's one thing that changes the world forever in the 1300s in Europe? Anyone remember?
Black Death.
1348. In the middle of the papacy looking weak, while it's still in France under the rule of the French kings, the Black Death enters the world. Here's the thing. If everything in your world starts crumbling down, everything familiar starts kind of going away, you do have a much more strong centralized power. As a human, you have much more say in what's going on. You can partake in pilgrimages. You can partake in the wars and armies. You can actually make a decent living in places. Monetary economy allows you to move up from a barter economy into maybe we could actually move to the city. The cities are wonderful places to live, right? You have access to all sorts of stuff. I mean, even here in Deposit, right? If you're going to go shopping, where are you going to go? You're going to go to Binghamton, the closest city, right? And, oh, yeah. There's one, but it's more expensive to go grocery shopping there than it is to drive to Binghamton and back, right? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, with no competition, right? Yeah. But, I mean, it's no comparison to the significance of what it was when in the rural villages, nobody really cares that much about the monetary economy compared to the cities. The cities in the early 1300s, the mid-1300s, had been starting to grow into a place where we say city, we think skyscrapers. Get that out of your mind. Get a whole lot of people together in a small area, and all their livestock is kind of there too, because essentially our culture is rural, but we're all living in cities that are way packed for what they really are. We still need to feed all of them. We don't have interstate highways, so right outside the city has to be all of our gardens and everything. You have to be able to grow a bunch of food. You have to be able to provide for all of this stuff. In order to do that, you have to have livestock. In order to do that, livestock got to poop. got to get rid of things. We don't have waste treatment plants yet. Problems start to develop. This is one of the aspects of when civilization comes to the cities, you have to figure out how to fix all of these things. And the problem is you have to learn the hard way, because no city is just going to learn it and get it right the first time. Not in that culture. You're coming from a very rural thing. Imagine when you move to the city, you don't just like sell your cows. You bring them with you. You know, if you know how to grow barley and you're going to try to make it as a blacksmith, you're still going to bring barley and you're going to plant it so you can ensure that that transition can happen. I mean, I'm just using little examples, but the reality is you can't just go, I'm going to move to the city and, you know, it's 1336, so I can be a graphic designer. I can be a painter or something. Nope. It's still an agrarian society. Yeah, there's no entrepreneur. You're not going to be, you know, that's not going to work. You still have to supply something for society. So think of it more as very densely packed rural agrarian society. That's more what the cities are like. The only thing you have, though, is a city wall protecting you. Because with the rise of the monetary policy, you don't get as much theft in a barter economy. Okay? Someone's not breaking in and stealing a ton of corn. But if they know that you've got gold and you've been able to liquefy your assets into something like that, the rise of banks, that's in the city. If you're in the rural world, guess what? People are going to be breaking in and stealing these things. And so living in the city has another benefit. You're not really going to be robbed as much. You have city walls, at least not by other people. Some people inside the city with you, however, that might happen. So it gives rise to things like bishoprics that have all of a sudden more people, so they can build more cathedrals, they can build more things. You have much more taxes flowing into the city, so the king, especially if you're in a capital city, the king becomes far more wealthy, but then he can hire more armies, which means it protects your borders. And all of these things are changing all at the same time. And when you're thinking of these cities, again, clustered rural agrarian folk all living together. And then 1347 comes along. The Black Death, as it was known, which now we call it in response, bubonic plague, was not just one plague, and it was not just one year. It was three different plagues. The bubonic plague, the pneumonic plague, and the septicemic plague. They all affected you differently, and they were all present at the same time. Some were airborne, some were through touch, others were through fleas or blood transfusion, or not transfusion, blood transmission through fleas and whatnot. But see, the thing is in order to get at how this affected people, you really have to get how they thought about sickness. Sickness was not germs, it was not bloodborne, it was not in the air. Well, it was in the air, but only in certain instances, and that was through miasmas, bad smells and so forth. But there was no theory of germs. None. Glass had not been perfected yet to the point that you could make things like microscopes. Nobody had seen a germ or bacteria or virus or anything like this. Also why there wasn't telescopes yet. It wasn't just because we waited until we were totes smart to invent these things. We did not have the ability to perfect glass yet. Without perfecting glass, you don't have telescopes, the knowledge of the extreme outer parts of space, nor do you have microscopes to see the extreme smallness of the things in this world. And so there was no knowledge about these things. And when you don't have knowledge about these things, and they come and they take out everybody, you have no idea what is going on. We have never seen a plague like this. The last one was the Justinian plague, which lasted for a comparatively short amount of time. And though it decimated a lot of people, nowhere near. And it also was the bubonic plague as well. This time, because cities had just developed, and because you have perfect transmission rates all over the place in cities themselves were absolutely destroyed by this. Now, we look at what we just went through the past 3 years. Not even in the same universe. Imagine instead of just telling everyone to stay home, everyone just died. You have no idea why. I mean, these days we can research things really quick, and we were just like, you know, we had already sequenced the DNA of COVID, what, in like a month or something? It was insane. I mean, it truly is an unbelievable feat of things that we were able to do. At that point, they didn't even know what was causing it. All they knew was, based on what cities it was hitting when, is that it was marching from east to west. And it was inevitable, it was unavoidable, and it was coming for you and all of your kids and all of your family and everyone you knew. And so all of a sudden, when it comes to town, there's no way to anticipate who it will affect, because some people are immune and other people, when they get it, they're gone in 3 days. And in some towns, just to show you how severe this is, there was some towns like Florence that over 2/3 of all the people in the town died. On Monday, you're perfectly fine. Tuesday, you have some black bumps and swollen lymph nodes. Wednesday, you're dead. There's no warning. There's no time. You do know that if you get close to somebody like that, you can increase your chance of it. And so what happens? You're constantly seeing, if somebody gets this, that's it, say goodbye. There's no cure. There's no help. There's no nothing. What does it do to an economy? What does it do to the mindset to all of a sudden lose over half the people in a town? Can you imagine? I mean, we look at that and we go, well, who's going to run this? Who's going to run that? Correct. Not only who's going to run it, who knows how to run it? We're losing knowledge. If all of a sudden the whole blacksmith's family is dead, nobody knows how to shoe horses, what does that do for economies? On top of that, all the farmers, all their children. When you deal with these aspects of it, it is so devastating to Europe that it really is hard to overstate how horrendous it actually was.
And even more immediately, who's going to deal with the bodies?
Correct.
There's so many.
Correct. You know how many people there were in the world in 1347? 500 million. Very good. 500 million people in the world. Whole world. Everywhere. That includes the Americas, that includes China, India, Africa, everything. 500 million people. Over the course of the 300 years that the bubonic plague ravaged Europe, now the first 3 years were the most significant, every 10 or 12 years it flared up again and everyone had to go on lockdowns. For centuries. Nobody ever talks about that. Martin Luther wrote about it as a time when he had to go on lockdown because of it. That kind of stuff was just part of the way of life, even up in the 1500s. Okay? So the majority of effect of it was the first 3 years, 1347 to 1351, and that just ravaged everything. But over the course of the 300 years that the bubonic plague was flaring up and going back and forth and everything like that, take a stab as to how many people died. There's 500 million people in the world about 1347.
At one point in time, it lasted 300 years.
Mm-hmm. 500 million.
Wow.
Yeah, there can be.
Right.
So 500 million?
Correct. Half a billion people, when at the beginning of the plague, there's only half a billion people in the world. You got to understand, it would be equivalent to us today having a plague over the next couple hundred years that wipes out 7.5 billion people. Okay, it's not. So when people talk about the end of the world, folks, that's what they thought was happening. This is the end of it all. We are all being taken out bit by bit. And where is it coming from? It's coming from where the sun rises. The direction of the Holy Land, the direction of the Garden of Eden. This is a scourge from God. And that was exactly how they described it. This is due to our sin. This is due to our lack of confession. This is due to our lack of contrition or repentance or something. Death became a space at the dinner table in every family, everywhere. And here's the thing. Think about this. You have a plague that's indiscriminate, old or young. What eventually happens when it takes out all the old and middle-aged and, you know, 20-somethings? Everyone who's naturally immune continues to live on. When it flares up, who's it taking out? All the young ones. This is what they had to experience for centuries. It just kept killing the kids. And so, the initial run-through destroyed and decimated Europe. It, by the way, had come from China beforehand, and it had decimated out there as well. But as far as for a church history class, we're not dealing all with that. But the reality is this was a worldwide issue, and the problem most significantly was in Europe because of cities. They had just developed city living again on a level that made plagues perfection. There was no better place for a plague to cross than a city. And as soon as it came to a port city, it spread to the next one, to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. And they were able to plot out it's coming from the east. This is obviously coming from God. It's not just that we lost people. It's that all of a sudden our infrastructure is going unused. You have houses that are just empty because it came through and killed everyone in the family. Right? I mean, when you're talking about something that has like a 40% death rate, it's not hard to find an entire family that just dies from it over the course of a week. Right? Empty house. Who's going to do anything with that? Who's going to go in there? What are you going to do? How are you going to fix anything? You cannot. You have unused infrastructure, calamity everywhere. Imagine worst medieval post-apocalyptic movie you could ever theorize. That's what Europe was like in about 1350. There was literal wars that were just put on pause because entire armies were coming down with this. And you lose 40% of your fighting forces, you're not going to war. That's just horrific. Scotland and France and England were all at war at the time, and they just stopped for a while because what are you going to do? If anything can make England and France stop fighting, maybe it's not 100% bad. But you got to imagine, at the same time, the late 1300s, early 1400s, the end of the medieval warm period, the rise of the Little Ice Age, which in Europe led to famine. On top of this, if you could grow things, you could make a pretty good living, because guess what? Most farmers are dead. And so what are you going to do? How are you going to imagine this? Inflation went through the roof. The value of things went so expensive, it's unthinkable. There was a need for labor. Here's the thing. A shortage with regards to all of the aspects of the world. The demand for food increased, and there was no infrastructure to meet it. Roads broke down because you can't repair anything. You have no ability to meet any of the needs as they come. The demand for labor skyrockets because there is nobody doing it. Nobody knew how to do. We lost multiple trades because the vast majority of everyone in them died. The lower middle class, all of a sudden, is in extremely high demand. And, yeah, what does that do? It shifts the power, doesn't it? Just in time. And if you're looking at the timeline and the flow of history, there's already been rumblings about things like the laity should have some say in what happens in the church. The people, the peasants, should have some say in what the king can and cannot do. There should be limits on government. There should be things that can happen. Well, all of a sudden, a peasant has a lot higher voice and a much louder voice than he ever had in any previous generation. And they revolt. They revolt against abusive taxation because for the states and for the countries that are fledgling, if anything, France is still young, powerful, but still young. It's not able to, no country is able to weather this. Can you imagine? It would be equivalent if the past 3 years, America lost 175 million people. We only have 350. Can you imagine losing half of our nation? Try to figure out how to get on without that. taxation would have to go through the roof because the government would try to have to fix something. And who's here but normal people? Because it indiscriminately took out people in cities, and people in cities tended to be those of higher nobility, those with more education. So when it tends to take out all of them, because cities were hurt far worse than the rural towns, all of a sudden the peasants have a much higher power and much louder voice. And they also have to bear the brunt of the taxation to bail out everybody. Sound familiar?
I was just going to say, just like now.
Yeah. There's a revolt against, there's several revolts against abusive taxations, and it starts shredding the power of some of these kings. And as far as the papacy, in the center of the Avignon papacy is when the Black Death hits Europe. Nobody cares what the Pope thinks. Nobody cares what the Pope thinks. The Pope can't even stand up to the French king. We can stand up to the French king. Who cares what the Pope thinks? And when you get a huge amount of the populace thinking, we do not care what the Pope thinks, that will affect theology like nothing else. All of a sudden, you have in art, in writing, in everything, theology turning extremely dark. The focus on death, hell, and the afterlife, and the ever-present threat that I'm here this week and most likely not the next. That changes the way you think about the world, doesn't it? If there is something out there, like imagine just this. Say all these chairs are full and then all of a sudden a third to a half of them are just gone. I mean, what things are important in your life anymore? When that threat is just sitting out there, you don't know if it's going to come back to town and take you out next time. You don't know if it was because you were more pious than them, but couldn't hurt to be more pious and try to do other things. All of a sudden, that whole relic trade that had been controlled so heavily by the papacy, guess what it does? It explodes. If we're going to go out, I'm going to go out swinging. I'm going to make sure I have my own relics so that I can have as much grace and as much stuff in my life as possible before I die. Theology becomes dark. If you look at some of these, the art at the time, you'll get things like death standing there with a sickle with a big old smile on his face, just waiting to take out the next group of people, just cut them all down. You'll see skeletons that are all dancing and having a great old time, just celebrating these things. We're about to, in the next couple weeks, celebrate something that came out of this time period called Halloween. This idea that there is just a ever-present force of death and those things that are looking to drag us down to it. That kind of stuff has an enormous amount of pull on people. And so that's why you still get things like Halloween, which is literally just short for All Hallows Eve. It's just the day before All Saints Day, which is November 1st. It's just the day before that. But you get this amalgamation of pagan traditions from their past with Christian theology trying to force it all together. That's where Halloween actually really finds a lot of its origin. Honestly, it has its origin in all sorts of things, but it tries to coalesce here to try to just express this. Now we just connect it with, you know, candy and things like this, but you're still looking at people's things. This is because of the Black Death. When you see skeletons decorating people's houses and things like this, still today, almost 700 years later, still the effects of it wear on. Now, do we know that? No, we're not aware of that at all. We just go, it's just a weird holiday we have. These things are the way of it. Certain ones who make up their mind to suffer for God, and that kind of theology, especially from certain monastic traditions, goes into supercharged, turbocharged mode. And instead of just suffering by living in this world, now we must flagellate ourselves. Now we must beat ourselves, taking whips and going up and down the city streets and flogging themselves, bleeding everywhere. I mean, this kind of stuff was, we are going to suffer. We are going to appease God because obviously he is angry with us. We need to assuage his anger with public penance, confession of any and all things by everyone all the time. You will see a complete shift in the art and the theology of the time from the narratives of Scripture to the death of Christ. And I don't mean that the crucifixion is not important and central. Certainly is. But it takes a much, much more central role at this period of time than at any time in the past. All of this contributes to the fall of the medieval age. When Europe finally comes out of this, it is a completely different place. So when we talk about things like, in retrospect, things like the Renaissance or the Reformation or the Enlightenment or any of these things, the world that was Europe was attempting to say, we are starting over again and we're going to do it right this time. Whether it's basing it on humanistic principles, or, you know, like René Descartes, which we'll spend some time on later on, or whether it's basing it on Roman ideals or on Greek philosophy or whatever in the Renaissance, all of a sudden that will affect the way we build things. It's why, like, even today, you go down to Washington, D.C., what are all of our buildings look like? They look like Greece and Rome. Why? They don't look American at all. They're not built in the colonial style. They're built in the Roman style and the Greek style. That's all the Renaissance. That's in the 1400s. That's Europe trying to remake itself. That affected us all the way to 1776, yes. And Enlightenment ideals founded this country as well. But the reality also is the Reformation finds absolute fertile ground. If there was ever a time to tell the Catholic Church to hit the road, it's going to be the 1500s. And wouldn't you know it? Is not going to come from the papacy that the church is going to be reformed. What is the other of the two-pronged medieval forces that's going to fix it? Monasteries. That's why a stupid little monk named Martin Luther, who just has the audacity to threaten the Pope's usage of indulgences, which he didn't know was with a papal approval. He thought it was just the indulgence preachers. Why can't we have a discussion about maybe these things should be thought of differently. Maybe these things should be done differently. And that starts the Reformation. Again, what was the first thing that the people's response to the Reformation? That the Peasants' War, 1524, revolted against everything. Church and state alike, because at that point they were essentially one.
Do you remember how many daggers is the peasants?
Yeah, I mean, especially for that area at that time. I believe the Peasants' War of the 1520s, I mean, I literally just jumped ahead 200 years to discuss that, but wasn't it 100,000? Which at that point was just unbelievable. Yeah, it was 100,000 was the initial estimates. Which was, imagine the weight that put on someone like Luther, who was being quoted as a defender of this. And he's like, this is not anything that I have. Right. But the problem with that kind of stuff is you will always be misheard and misinterpreted when people are desperate. Yep. Yes, indeed. The relationship between the average Christian and relics shifts dramatically. When you have the ability, perhaps, and what used to be something very closely controlled by the Catholic Church, what now, when you live in constant fear of death in this world, because God is obviously judging us, what does that make you think about when you see him this moment you die? Is it going to be a joyful entrance into paradise, or are you going to meet this absolutely ridiculous tyrant the moment you pass, and what do you expect? You're not a monk, you're not a pope, you're nothing. and you're just going to see God, what do you think? He's going to approve of you? And that doesn't work like that. You need more grace. You need more, you need more, you need more. And that's the attitude that was coming at it. How can we get more? Well, the indulgence preachers that began going around the world in the 1400s, in the early 1500s, were essentially the equivalent of today's televangelists. Going out there and giving hope to people that actually disappoints. And they were using church teaching to do this. The church had discussed relics as something that was a means of God's grace. You could get time off in purgatory. Remember, the monasteries had come up with all sorts of things from the rule of St. Benedict and things like this, where there was, you know, if you commit this sin, it's this much time in purgatory. And it was meant to dissuade people from sinning. It wasn't meant to be used as a club to get money out of people. But here's the thing. When you have that kind of influence, that kind of power, eventually it will be misused by somebody. And that's exactly what happened with the teaching of relics. Now, was the teaching of relics wrong? Yes, always. Absolute nonsense. Medieval mysticism. But the reality is, whether it was well-intentioned in the beginning or not, is what I'm saying, most likely well-intentioned by a lot of people. The problem was is that you're going to get some real rotters coming in teaching something else entirely, where you're taking one aspect of a teaching on relics and then running with it. And the idea of where the church was, and when the church gets desperate and it needs money, well, guess what? We already have an established revenue stream. If Christians can give donations in the name of a saint while they're seeing one of their relics, well, I mean, you can just purchase the indulgence for that. You can buy grace is eventually where that goes. I mean, literally, the terminology eventually got so bad that it was so much grace for so little coin. Can you imagine? But the reality is that's that kind of concept of it existed. And it wasn't like people were going, oh, well, I don't know what else to do. No, they were desperate for this because that's the only way I can get it. Because the last thing I'm going to do is just die and have to face this jerk called God without any protection whatsoever. And when death is constantly surrounding you and you've lost half of your children to either the plague or just to the normal infant mortality rate, you're constantly surrounded by this. When they start telling you that you can actually purchase relatives that have gone on before you out of purgatory, that's a whole nother layer. Now you added desperation with guilt. You can make people do anything. And this is kind of one of the realities. And televangelists do the exact same thing, don't they? You give me some seed money. It always comes down to money. Always. Give me some seed money, and that will that in and of itself is an act of faith, and that faith will purchase a miracle from God, and your bank account will grow, your sickness will go away, this person will get better, whatever the case may be, right?
What'd you say?
You'll reap what you sow.
Oh. Yeah.
Tenfold.
There's always going to be somebody to take the fall for things. One of the groups.
The practice of the church as a whole, that it was these preachers.
Initially. The church, all it needs. All it needs is an unscrupulous pope. And by the way, in the early 1500s, it was Pope Leo. Perfect. He wanted to build St. Peter's Basilica. And in order to do that, he had to take out an enormous sum of money from the I forget their name. It starts with an F, from the bankers. Anyway, and they had to pay it off. And in order to pay it off, they took some of the most unsavory preachers of indulgences and gave them real special indulgences. I mean, John Tetzel, for instance. We're not talking about the Reformation tonight. We're kind of working our way up to it. But John Tetzel was quoted at one point of saying that he has an indulgence that you could purchase that He could absolve any sin, including if a man violated the mother of God herself. You can rape the Virgin Mary, and I can still, based on this papal approval, forgive that sin and absolve you of any guilt whatsoever. Just pay us money. I mean, it's remarkable, some of the things that were being expressed. And again, the desperation for money, more power, etc. These things finally do in the Western Church. It's common for us, I think, to think in retrospect that, you know, the only people who wanted to reform the church were those who broke off and became Protestants. That's not true. Almost everyone in the Catholic Church understood that the church needed full reformation. They just didn't agree that you could separate out and become another entity from the Roman Catholic Church. And that's where that really big issue comes from. And that's why there was counter-reformation inside the Catholic Church. Most Protestants don't know about this. Multiple attempts throughout the 1500s to remake the Catholic Church, to fix it, because honestly, it was an absolute hellhole. Let me talk about one of the effects, because this will help explain some of the aspects to come. One of the groups of people that were blamed for the plague, or at least suspected for it, were the Jews, especially in the West. Now, there's a lot of theories as to why this is, but straight up numbers is one of the most sure things. Jews had hardly any people die from the plague, which before germ theory really, really, really looks bad. Now, the standard explanation today is most likely because Europeans as a whole did not have cats as pets. They saw it as connected to witchcraft. Again, remind you of Halloween, cats, black cats crossing your path, bad luck, all this stuff. Jews coming from the East did not have that issue. They had cats as pets all the time. How did the bubonic plague transmit? We know this now. Fleas on rats. Where do rats not want to go? But to neighborhoods where there's a whole bunch of cats. The most basic explanation is almost because they had cats as pets. But nobody knows this at the time. Nobody. You can't be expected to know it. And so you have Jewish people who tend to have cats as pets on a much higher scale than anybody else in Europe. But to the rest of everyone's minds, it looks like the Jews have determined something that's able to kill all of us, but not them. That looks really bad. And there's absolutely no way to deal with it. Now, there's always been kind of a anti-Jewishism in the West. The Eastern Church, not so much. They've always lived side by side. They've had several aspects of them. But, you know, we don't want to be Jews, but we don't really want to get rid of them or anything like that. Plus, they have all their own headaches over in the Eastern Church anyway. But in the West, there's always a level of suspicion. You guys couldn't even defend your own country. We had to send the Crusades to liberate all of you. And you're here doing this and getting involved with this and that. And there's always just been a real deep anti-Jewishness anyway.
Of course, you killed Christ.
Yes. You killed the Christ, right. And then you lost the Holy Land. I mean, it really is a great deal of historical issues that go with this. This adds gasoline to that fire. And it's why you come to places like Germany, which had a much more significant and higher resistance to any Jewishness at all. It's why you'll get people like Hitler quoting people like Martin Luther, talking about Jews in very derogatory ways. It's not because Luther was unique. It's because he was European in the late Middle Ages. Everyone hated them. And nobody knew any normal, natural explanation as to why this is. Why is it they weren't dying from the plague anywhere near as many numbers as we are? And that's a really sad part of history to try to just trace it back and go, oh my gosh, they had cats as house pets. And realize that that turned so much history, just what pet they had in their home. Now, is that for sure? No, that's the prevailing theory. We know they had cats as pets. We know that the bubonic plague was through rats, and we know that their numbers were way lower. Seems to make perfect sense to me. whatever the reason was, their numbers of fatalities were extremely low compared to anything else.
And we know that as a culture, they tended to be to maintain their segregation from others, yeah, other groups.
Right.
So that would minimize that kind of
correct. Transition. Correct. And the most basic understanding of what was killing everyone had to be waterborne somehow. That was what they thought. That it was a waterborne illness somehow, so it must have been, and people can poison wells. Whatever it is, it seems intentional. And there was a lot of violence and a lot of killing. This is what fear does, and as it always is, and one of the history books I use to prep these says that at this point it was a time of fear, and fear demanded victims. That's the way it always works. It is hard to overstate how much it changes, but as we go forward, expect some of the most massive changes. Countries reestablish themselves after massive tragedies. It takes time, takes a lot of money, takes a lot of manpower and intentionality, but countries usually come out of it. Churches don't. This, when this level of authority is challenged, when the papacy is seen not only as a puppet of the French king during the entirety of the bubonic plague, but also completely impotent at stopping what everybody agreed was a scourge from God, what good is the Pope? What can he actually do? They can't stop this. They can't solve it. They don't know what to do. That leads to really deep distrust of that office. Now, don't think of it in terms of like American Revolution, you know, against King George III type distrust. Not like that. This is a, hey, do you actually have all this authority or not? And the rise of challenging papal authority really comes to the fore. Most Christians are not aware. Most Protestants are not aware. I would actually probably say most Catholics today are not aware because nobody knows their own history anymore. But the doctrines of papal infallibility and all that kind of stuff, that's the stuff of the 1800s. That did not exist in the 1300s. It wasn't until Vatican I in 1870 that that was determined. That's 152 years ago. Okay, that's not what's on the table back there. Nobody's looking at the Pope and going, oh, infallibility. If he speaks on the throne, ex cathedra, then he is, you know, infallible in what he actually fully declares. It's, he has spiritual authority. But what starts rising with the rise of the lower classes, the peasant classes as well, and this isn't just class struggle, but there is a lot of it going on, is, hey, what's the point of having a pope that has all of this unquestionable spiritual authority that even kings supposedly can't question? What if you're wrong? Like, who's your check? Because it's not the other autocephalous, the other heads of the church in the East. Nobody cares about the Eastern Church at this point. Who's the check on the Bishop of Rome? What if a council meets together? Can they undo a pope? And this gives rise to what is called conciliarism, which is one of the things we're going to be spending a whole night on when we start going into the late 1400s, mid-1400s. How is it that we deal with this idea that a council can meet together and elect a pope, but that pope can then overturn whatever that council says? Who's actually got the authority in the church now? Now it's not even a discussion of between popes and kings. We determined who won that. Kings won that. There's just no two ways about it. Philip did that for us, thankfully. But when it comes to now in the church, now the Pope's not even trying for the kings. I mean, he'll try to influence things, and actually you will find out that several popes are related to the kings, which is really more interesting. But even inside the church now, there needs to be a check or a balance on you. There needs to be something on you. Is there, what about councils? And church councils, Council of Florence, for instance, or several others, can these councils come in and overrule popes?
Do you think part of the reason for that mistrust of the pope was because the punishment might because of the church leaders.
Say that again.
Received punishment from God. The plagues might have been.
So that was part of it. Another part of it was obvious that the office of the papacy was being controlled by the French throne during the Avignon papacy for 70 years. An additional part of it is that there was multiple popes at certain points, and councils had to come in and work through that mess. And so who is actually the pope? Now, so think with me how influential this is. We as Protestants don't really deal with a sacerdotal system, this idea that the church is the source of God's grace to us. We don't interact with it like that. So it's thoroughly dependent on your priest, right? Because when you come, you're not just remembering the body and the blood of Christ. You are receiving the grace of God through a miraculous event on that altar that has bones of saints in it, okay? In order for that to be legitimate, your priest must be connected to the pope. Now you live at a time where there's two popes.
Yeah, which am I actually deceiving Jesus?
Only if it's the correct pope. You say, well, then which one's the correct one? Well, isn't that a water cooler argument for everyone to have? And here's the real problem. When everyone starts throwing canon law at each other because your very soul sleep depends on whether or not that guy is the pope or that guy is the pope, and guess what? They've excommunicated each other and everyone who follows them. What did that do to the average parishioner sitting in the pew? Completely divides the church. You have to depend that your parish priest actually has chosen the right side. And guess what? If he hasn't, you're in for a world of hurt.
And you want to go to two separate masses, just go to
non-confession. Well, you better hope you do them in the right order. You do the correct one last. But I mean, we kind of talk about it in a joking manner, but this was people's lives. Right? We talk about a papacy that, you know, there was multiple popes at one point, and we just go like, oh, what a bunch of rubes or whatever. When we're talking about just think about the average barley farmer that just comes in for mass. I'm just here for this. I don't even know what is being said. It's all in Latin. I have no earthly idea. But I do know that if I'm not the right one, I'm going to hell. Or I will spend eons longer in purgatory. Because my parish priest wasn't connected to the right pope. That is the word of the century. So much fear. And when people are afraid, what happens? Desperation. And so when the pope, when that whole thing is figured out with two popes, and we know who the real pope is, and only in retrospect do we determine who the anti-pope was, really convenient title, then when that pope, that new pope, then releases indulgences, you will pay anything for that. It doesn't matter how expensive. It doesn't matter anything. You will pay your way down right now, best as you can, fast as you can, and you're going to watch parish priests not know how to deal with that. We're going to watch people that are monks wrestle with the reality. You're going to watch that kind of power corrupting the church significantly in the 1400s because people are afraid, and rightly so, and they're desperate for a solution. Desperate for a solution. We're going to stop that there. If I open the next topic, we'll be here all night. Any questions at all, or any just thoughts about all of these things? Can you kind of feel the winds of change in the medieval time becoming all the challenges of the 1400s and 1500s? That is where we're going. We'll be at the Reformation before Thanksgiving. But yeah, any thoughts or wonderments about this?
Well, the cities weren't self-dependent. They got a lot of imports from all over the place, and that could have bolstered a lot.
Yes. Yes, you're talking about in the initial 3 years of the wave. Yes. You can actually find maps of this where it, you can see how far it went each year, because every plague, every pandemic lasts about 3 years and then fizzles out. First year is the surprise. Second year is the worst. Third year is, you know, taking out the last stragglers that avoided everything. You know, I mean, same thing happened with the Spanish flu, 1918, 1920, or whatever it was. It's 3 years. It kind of does that. Well, this past one we just did, 3 years. That's how they go, three seasons. And so as far as for cities, the ones in the West were able to support the ones in the East because of what was happening, but only so much. I mean, how when a city loses that many, there's no helping that city. And the thing was, is people did not know how these things were, how it was transmitted. They knew sickness is transmitted, obviously. They had no idea how. Imagine trying to help somebody and you have no idea how something transmits. You don't know what to do. I mean, people knew in our own pandemic, we knew that it was through the air. People were losing their minds on something with what was the survival rate of COVID towards the end?
Oh, it was like 98.
Yeah, I mean, it was above 99, whatever it was, extremely high. Mortality rate under 1%, right? I mean, the Spanish flu, 19... Right, exactly. And we knew that you had to have comorbidities and all sorts of other stuff. And still people who were perfectly healthy in their 20s were losing their minds. We live in very comfortable times. Imagine something that if you get it is a 40% mortality rate and you have no idea how it's transmitted and there's no personal protection equipment whatsoever. Are you going to volunteer to go help that city out? No, nobody's going to do that. You will probably go and set a cart of food outside the city walls, and you're going to hightail it the heck out of there. But that's about as much as you're ever going to help.
Cities just have a pandemic when they lost.
Say again?
2/3 of their population. What do you move?
So, yeah, a lot of people did. A lot of people, well, yeah, as soon as somebody is sick in your house, you leave them in the house and you move. You get out of town. And people weren't really understanding yet that it was localized to cities. Again, you're not dealing with communication lines that are that significant. Everyone's dying.
It makes me wonder how they knew it was coming from the East.
They knew when...
Yes,
it traveled fast enough, yes. And one of the main reasons for that, by the way, is the reason why the West knew so much of what was going on with the port cities in the Mediterranean was that the Moors were chased out of Spain right before this or right around the same time, and... Christian nations finally had control of the Straits of Gibraltar, so you could actually sail from England to Greece in a matter of 3 weeks. So, what's that? Yes, and as we find out, that ships actually are the source of a lot of these, which is why port cities were hit the hardest. But then rats don't just like ships, they also like grain fields and ox carts and everything. And that's why it takes several years, but eventually it goes through everything. And you are talking about a time where personal hygiene was not exactly apex either, and once fleas are on you...
Especially with the start of cities, you have to have so much condensing of sewage. And there is a waste of all...
Yeah. Infrastructure is dirt roads between the closely built houses, and on these dirt roads... Animals and people and defecation and everything is everywhere, and that's just the end of it. I mean, that was just the way of it. It wasn't, I mean, even up until the 1800s, you had people throwing, you know, bedpans right up. I don't know about that, but I do know. What wasn't it in French? Didn't they like call it Gardilou? When they threw it out the window, I think it's French for "watch out for the water," you know, something like that. But
what was the name of the third type of plague?
Septicemic. Septicemic.
Is that related to fecal?
Yeah. Infection. And that one would kill you kind of the fastest. That one was infection based and yeah.
So it's stomach.
No.
Body wide. Yeah, lymphatic system. So like on your lymph nodes, you would get a little swollen and then severely swollen, then huge black pustules. Yeah. That's where black death came from. The color of the growths. There, your armpits, extraordinarily painful, insanely infectious, and there is no cure. Today, you can take a pill and it's gone. I mean, we had bubonic plague, I think we had a guy in Colorado got it from a bat like 2 years ago or something like that. He's fine. Yeah, I mean, but it still, without treatment, has that level of death to it. But it's insanely easy to treat with modern medicine. But you can see why the desperation to solve things like that really starts filling up the minds of people. And when, again, mid-1400s, huge transition point for a lot of things. What's the thing that comes from China? Not the plague. Movable type printing press. Finally comes to Europe from China. They were the ones that actually invented it. And you can print books now. What does that do for literacy rates? What does that do for knowledge transmission and people being able to read things and people being able to study things and opening it up universities to all sorts of people and all sorts of things? And this is one of the reasons why the Reformation took off so well. Luther literally just printed up his writings in little booklets and off they go. It'll affect the world. And he wrote in German, something people could read, rather than what all theological arguments had to take place was in Latin. And so, yes. Yes. Well, Latin's a great language for that, but I mean, goodness. So, alrighty. Well, let's end it there. Thank you guys very much. This is one of the cooler aspects of it, but we get into some really interesting stuff from here on out. And once we get to the Reformation, it's one of my favorite, probably is my favorite section of church history. We'll get there.
I think it's been thinking about the plague doctors, too, and all that they tried to do, how their thinking went, and how they came up with such interesting.
While they thought it was initially caused by waterborne illnesses, they thought it spread from person to person through smell and through the air. And so that was what I referred to earlier as the miasmas, was the idea that bad smells carry sickness on it, which makes sense. You go to a sick house, and what does it smell like? Something good or something bad? There you go.
It makes a lot more sense than assuming that there's magical germs in the air that are invisible and undetectable.
That's true. Don't you know that there's 10 trillion bugs floating in this air right now? Yeah.
And a lot of bronze already.
Yeah, no matter how clean you are, you still are crawling with tens of thousands of bugs. Yay.
What'd you say? Within and without.
Yes.
Yeah. And you
Well, on that note.